would be retaliated against and probably lose his job for another reason the next day. And that's one of the reasons why this is a good idea. Do you feel if we didn't have this, we'd have to have better retaliations laws? Is that what you're...
Well, I'm just saying it's difficult for the employees to come forward against their employer and say, you know, I'm not getting what I should be paid because, you know, undoubtedly they're, you know, the job security is what they're, you know, concerned about. And so we just see this as a way for, you know, another agency like Boley or someone else that has documentation that, you know, people are not getting what they, you know, should be, can step forward and say, this person, you know, is not getting what he should be paid on this job, and they can investigate it after that.
Would you, Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
Would you see this coming as maybe anonymous tips to the Boley as how the Boley would get involved? Is that how would you?
It could be that type of situation, or it could be an employee calling Boley rather than calling him his employer.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to testify today. My name is John Moldis, and I've been a business representative for Bricklayers and Allied Craftsmen Local Number 1 for 2 years. During this time period, I've monitored several prevailing rate jobs attempting to determine compliance with the laws by various contractors around the Portland metro area and Salem and around the state. Many jobs have appeared to be clean, and however, many certainly have not been. There's many frequent dodges to get around the law. One is to work their employees 8 hours a day and turn around and pay them for five and six. I've got sheets and sheets of certified payrolls from public works jobs where no one ever works 8 hours a day or 40 hours a week. Excuse me. Everybody works 3, 4, 6, 7, 0 hours. They also misclassify their employees to get a cheaper rate for them. When I've documented some of these tactics and taken them to Boley, they have told me that they cannot pursue the case without a wage claim from an employee. Most employees, however, hesitant to step forward because they will fear that they will lose their job. And our industry and most of the construction building trades are small enough where, as these gentlemen have said, if you file a complaint, 2 days later you'll find yourself laid off for some other reason. And the industry is small enough so that not only have they lost their job from that person, they will be, or from that employer, they will be branded as a troublemaker, and they won't find a job from any other employer in this area that's going to make them anywhere near the wages that they're making in a good building trades job. This good bill would help solve this problem, and if it passes, my members will benefit, but the main beneficiaries will be fair and honest contractors. And I urge you to vote this out of committee with the due pass recommendation.
Yeah, I have a little bit of a problem with your attitude that all employers are bad. I don't think that's true. I think most employers do abide by the law.
But
from your testimony, I'm reading that everybody's out to take advantage of the poor work, and I don't think that's true.
If you read that into my testimony, that's a misreading. Nothing could be further from the truth. We have a number of excellent Mason contractors in the area that we have very harmonious relationships with, and there are many open shop contractors that follow the law to the letter, and we don't have a problem with them. As long as the playing field is level, we feel that we can compete with them, and the ones that are running a fair, safe, honest business, if they want to be open shop, that's their choice, and we don't have a problem with that at all. It's the few that are out there cheating on a steady basis that we feel is unfair, and this bill would help clean up some of these problems because, as we all said earlier, people aren't going to come and sign a complaint because they know they're going to lose their jobs. And some of these people, after being employed for some of these companies, have been laid off after working for a long stretch. Then they come to me or to Boley, and then they'll sign a complaint. But they won't as long as they have a chance at a job that's, as Scott indicated, maybe not paying the right rate, but it's close, better than nothing.
Mr. Chairman, I want to point out that John Mollis is sitting between two Mason contractors here, and he wouldn't obviously be here. We wouldn't be here as a group, labor management, and the Institute if he felt that that there was anything but a small minority of contractors that are consistently taking advantage of the system.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much for coming today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we have Valerie Salisbury. Ms. Salisbury, thank you for coming today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. I'm Valerie Salisbury with the League of Oregon Cities. The League has some very serious problems with this bill. As public contracting agencies, we feel that cities will be adversely affected and that this bill will serve to transfer a great deal of the risk and the burden and the cost of enforcing prevailing wage claims or other wage claims from BOLI to the contracting agencies and specifically to cities. If I may explain that a bit, typically our contracts call for compliance with the prevailing wage laws. In fact, invariably they do. We enforce those in public works construction contracts. We also typically have a provision that allows us to retain up to 5% of the contract price. And the purpose of that retainage is to ensure that the contractor completes the contract. Sometimes it's difficult when you get to the end of a project and there's just a little bit of stuff left to be done, there's no real profit left in the contract, to get the contractor to come back and pay attention to full completion. The retainage gives us a tool to get our work completed, to get the full value for the public dollar. This bill would allow BOLI, without even making demand on the contractor itself, to come directly against the contracting agency and to strip funds not only out of the retainage, but out of any other contract funds available on that project. We are concerned that that leaves the public contracting agency in an extremely vulnerable position. It is not inconceivable that a project could be 85% complete and that the funds, remaining funds, would have been stripped out of the contract and used to satisfy wage claims. The city would then be in a position of having an incomplete project. It would be very difficult to make the contractor come back and complete the work when there wasn't another nickel left to pay. We would have the obligation at that point to complete the contract ourselves or to hire someone else to complete the project.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, go ahead.
With your contracts that you set, don't you have an agreement that they will pay the prevailing wage?
Absolutely.
And if because BOLI had, because there was a violation and BOLI had taken that reserve, wouldn't you still have a contract that you could enforce upon that contractor?
We would have a contract, and the contract would certainly be enforceable. Enforcement would be very difficult and very expensive. It would not, and I'd like to point out why, enforcing the prevailing wages provisions are not as expensive or as difficult for BOLI. That is for this reason. Once the city, for example, has completed the contract or hired someone else to do it, we have a claim against the contractor's surety. BOLI also has the same claim against the contractor's surety. If BOLI makes the claim directly against the surety company after the contractor has refused to pay, the issues are very narrow. They are confined to the question of the wage claim. If the contracting agency, on the other hand, is forced to go against the surety, the issues can be involve any issues from the inception of the contract through its completion. It becomes a very broad lawsuit. Typically, the legal expenses, in my experience at least, excuse me, and I have a little experience with it, legal expenses for a surety litigation action it would not be uncommon for them to range between $10,000 and $25,000 to prosecute a successful claim on a contract against a surety company. Those are funds that the city will now be required to bear because the scope of the action is very much broader. Bolee, as I say, would have a very narrow issue, and my assumption is that it would be much easier to enforce that claim against the surety and much less expensive.
So what would you see as being the best way to enforce the prevailing wage? The other option would be, I guess, is for Bolee to shut down the contractor. Then you're caught just in the exact same position.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Domine, in fact, the law now allows the contracting agencies to use retainage to satisfy wage claims. And my understanding is that that is often done, that cities voluntarily pay the wage claims out of retainage. I'm not aware of a case where demand has been made on a city and a city has failed to get the claim satisfied. In our opinion, this bill leaves us very vulnerable by providing Bolee with a very easy remedy against us, not against the wrongdoer, but against us. And we will be penalized the additional contract completion costs and the legal costs of enforcing a claim against a surety. That is our concern.
Chairman.
Yes.
If we stripped away the provision that the public agency should pay on an order for wages from funds due to the contractor, and if we stripped that away from this bill, how would you feel about the bill?
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, I assume that would leave the issue of the assignment of wage requirement, and I don't think that we have a particular problem with that. We are interested in the laws being enforced. I'm not sure as a practical matter that there is substantial likelihood that the claims will be brought and investigated without involving the name of the person who complained. But that does not concern us. We are concerned that the prevailing wage laws be enforced.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Again, thank you very much for coming today. And
thank you, Mr.
Bob, giving
Bob,
us your point of view.
Bob.
Oh, excuse me, Bob.
The 5% retention that you alluded to earlier, is that established by the municipalities or is that something by some higher authority?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Repine, that's established by state law as a maximum.
So if we were going to use this as another kind of sinking fund concept, we should also be considering raising the level of retention then too. If we were contemplating letting this being the savings account for other people, then maybe 10 to 15% would be more in line with establishing retention, which, in my experience, that's a retention fee that's passed on to the general contractor, who usually in turn turns around and passes that same retention clause on to his subcontractor.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Repine, to answer your question in two parts, obviously, if the retainage and the contract funds are to be available for broader purposes than completing the contract, our comfort level will be much higher if the retainage amount is higher. Secondly, yes, the effect of retainage is to withhold parts of the profit, parts of perhaps the cost, to the end of the project to ensure that the contractor has a reasonable incentive for completing the project. I would assume that those withholdings are in turn passed along to the subcontractors through the agreements with the contractors.
Ms. Salisbury, if we were to do that, wouldn't you then also raise the cost of the project if more retainage was required to be held?
Mr. Chairman, it's very likely that you would. Often, Public Works construction contracts operate on a fairly straightforward cash flow basis. Mm-hmm. To the extent that you have to build in more operating cash flow, yes, you probably raise the ultimate cost of the public.
You'd raise the cost of projects then for the cities and counties and so on.
That would be my expectation.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
You usually find on the typical contract, public contract, that if it's, there's a 5% retention, you can well suspect the contractor, the primary contractor, or, and or the subcontractors have made their bid at 105 plus.
Okay.
So they're going to make sure they get their 100% without that retention.
Yeah. You contractors have it figured out, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
It just didn't fall off the turnip truck.
Okay. Again, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, maybe some of us did.
Okay. See, we have Bill Wilkerson.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee
person. Thank you for coming today.
I'm with the Floor Carving Union in Washington, or Southwest Washington and Oregon. And we also have a an association, and Jerry's not here this morning, but I'm speaking in favor of Senate Bill 35. I really wasn't prepared to speak this morning, but excuse me. We also face the same problems of getting audits done by prevailing wage because we can't get the workman out on a project to step forward and admit that he's being paid less, or because he too is afraid of job security. And we have had several problems where I've tried to bring it to the agency's attention, and because we couldn't get someone to step forward, it was just overlooked. The Portland Airport was a perfect example of, or maybe a poor example of what was happening out there. You had 8 or 9 people working and 2 or 3 people showing up on the prevailing wage certificate. And without someone stepping forward to say that they actually worked on the project, you couldn't get, you couldn't obtain an audit or an investigation of any kind. And this goes on occasionally. I wouldn't say it goes on every day, but there's a numerous jobs going out there that are state or county or city where you do have contractors who are not playing by the rules. It makes it very difficult for employers who are paying their fair share to compete in this marketplace. I would hope you would endorse 35. I don't like the idea of increasing the retainage fees. I think that would create quite a problem. And that's really about all I have to say.
Thank you much for your help. Jim Mingo. Thank you for coming this morning.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Kim Mingo, and I represent the Associated General Contractors. And our association is opposed to Senate Bill 35. We have several concerns with this bill. To begin with, we are concerned with the ability of the Bureau of Labor to file or to adjudicate wage claims without them being assigned to the Bureau. We feel that the current statutes allow the Bureau of Labor to pursue non-compliant contractors, and yet it stops any type of harassment against complying contractors. We are also concerned with subsection 6 of section 2. We feel that this would hurt not only prime contractors but subcontractors as well. We feel that prime contractors, in order to avoid paying twice, will require their subs to either post a bond or they will retain funds due the contract subcontractor for a longer period of time to ensure that no claims have been made against the subcontractor. This hurts small subcontractors. Also, we feel the language line 12 that states funds that may become due a contractor is vague, and our concern is for situations where a contractor may have a subcontract for work on a project and potentially may have monies due at some point in that contract period, but that contractor does not perform. We're afraid that because of this language where it states may become due a contractor, BOLI could go after funds that potentially that subcontractor may have but may not actually have due. because that subcontractor eventually did not perform the work. We are also concerned with a section that extends the ability of BOLI to file claims against the contractor's bond. I think in the testimony previous, there was a statement made that this bill would help complying contractors. I would disagree with that. This bill would hurt complying contractors, especially in those situations where the contractor who owes the money is a subcontractor. That subcontractor is the one who owes the money and not the prime contractor or the other subcontractors on the job. Yet BOLI can go after the monies due the prime contractor. They can go after the prime contractor's bond. Normally on a public works project, subcontractors only post bonds if the prime contractor requires them to. This allowing BOLI the additional time to go after a prime contractor's bond basically holds that bond hostage. It hurts them in obtaining bonds for other jobs, and this is for monies that they themselves do not owe. It's owed by another contractor. We're also concerned that in this situation that BOLI could go after a prime contractor's funds on a project that the monies were not due on, and I'm going to explain that. For example, the City of Portland, a prime contractor has a job, a contract with the City of Portland. He employs a subcontractor who on a previous job with the City of Portland did not pay prevailing wages. BOLI has an order outstanding against that subcontractor. Our concern is that BOLI could go after the funds owed against the subcontractor on another City of Portland job. There's nothing in this language that states that cannot happen, and that's our main concern, is that they would go after funds due on other jobs where the prevailing wage was paid.
Any questions?
Yes. How do you put together a contractor with a subcontractor? Don't you have some pretty strong language in there about them being required to pay prevailing wage and stuff? Isn't that a part of your contract with a subcontractor?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dominey, if it's a public works project, we are required by statute to put in our subcontracts statements that require the subcontractor to pay prevailing wages.
And all we're talking about in this bill is those people who violate the law. And so I guess I'm having trouble with the analysis that it's going to cost all contractors, because we're only talking about those contractors or subcontractors that are violating the law.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dominey, that's correct, but what we're trying to point out is that there are situations where the subcontractor is a non-complying, has not paid prevailing wages on the job. There is an order outstanding against them from BOLI. BOLI will go after the funds that will either go after the bond of the prime contractor, because it's the prime contractor who posts the payment performance bond, not the subcontractor. Also, BOLI can go after the funds owed to the prime contractor from the public agency. So what we're trying to say is that the prime contractor, who is a complying contractor, and other subcontractors on the job who are complying contractors are hurt because BOLI steps in and takes funds that are due them also.
Mr. Chair,
go ahead.
Just one last question, Chair. Don't you do any kind of a check with that subcontractor in advance to see what kind of a quality subcontractor you're getting?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dominey, it's my understanding that our prime contractors check to the best of their ability if the subcontractor is falsifying their certified payrolls, and to us, after we have checked them, they look fine and they have turned those in and have certified that they have paid prevailing wages. There is only so much that a prime contractor can do.
Do you ever follow up on somebody who you find out later has lied to you?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dominey, I'm aware in certain situations where prime contractors do follow up against their subs who they suspect are not complying, but I can't answer for all prime contractors whether they do or don't. I know that if they are suspecting or aware that someone is non-complying, then I would assume that they would, because they are required by statute.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any other questions? And thank you much for your help.
Thank you.
We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 35, and we're going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 741.
Gentlemen, Senate Bill 741, A, engrossed, came to you from Senate Labor with a 4-0 vote. I have the Senate floor vote also on your staff measure summary. In short, this bill would clarify the Employment Appeals Board standard of review of referee orders, and what that means in plain people language is that when the board reviews a referee order, it's how they review it. If they're reviewing the evidence, or if they're reviewing the facts, if they're reviewing whether the decision was reasonable. In this particular case, de novo review means they get to take a fresh look at the facts. That doesn't mean they get to hear the testimony in front of them again, but they get to review the testimony and see if they think it's credible. The very narrow issue here is to what extent the Employment Appeals Board must give credit to a referee's implied finding of credibility of evidence. In other words, the referee could come to a decision and make a decision about whether that testimony or that evidence was credible evidence, but he may not expressly say that in an order. A recent Court of Appeals case has indicated that the Employment Appeals Board must give credit to these implied credibility findings, which is a slightly different standard of de novo review than other reviewing boards have. This bill would clarify that they have the same de novo review as other review boards, including other review courts.
Okay, we have Mr. Mason.
Ms.
Mason, excuse me. Close. Well, I wasn't very close. Good morning.
Thank you for the opportunity. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Renee Mason. I'm the current chairperson of the Employment Appeals Board. With me is another board member, Christine Shute. This is probably one of the most obscure issues you will have to deal with this session, but it's very important to our agency because of the time and effort that we have to put into reviewing the decisions of referees that come from the Employment Division. For those of you who don't know us, we are a separate agency from the Employment Division, and our charge is to review unemployment insurance compensation cases that are appealed to us based on a referee's administrative decision. We thought about 4 years ago that we understood what our job was and what de novo review was and what the scope of our review was. And the court in the last year has consistently told us that we have misunderstood that. We are at odds with the court on that, and we believe that the court has misunderstood something. What we hope to do with this bill are a number of things, as we set out in our written testimony, to establish a consistent standard for de novo review, and to codify, in this instance, Supreme Court language, which tells reviewing agencies like ourselves, original fact finders like ourselves, when we have to make credibility findings. This is very important for us because statute and case law has told us that we have to review every issue that is raised on a record. However, if we see other issues that perhaps a referee did not, and the referee may not have addressed that issue for a variety of reasons, the Court of Appeals will infer that the referee must not have believed that.
See that last part?
The Court of Appeals will infer that the referee must not have believed whatever testimony established that issue. And in fact, it may be that the referee sneezed at that particular time. He didn't hear what the party said. We believe it serves the parties to simply address the issues that they raise without having to guess why the referee may or may not have addressed particular issues and facts.
Maybe I could ask a question, because I've not ever been involved in this process before, but when you are reviewing just information that's in a printed form.
Correct. Correct.
You don't have the opportunity of interviewing the particular person.
That's correct.
Isn't there, I mean, I would think that in a personal contact, you'll pick up a lot more information than you perhaps can read in just written materials. And what I see the bill saying is that if a referee perhaps feels a certain way and you don't read that in his report, then you would say that you don't have to consider that. And I guess the real problem is
Chairman Derfler,
what you're trying to do there.
Let me try to give you an example here.
Can I chime in?
Sure.
I used to be a referee for 3 years in workers' comp. And what you're telling us is that they're not using the same standard, the same approach. Now, in workers' comp, I got deference as to credibility. If I said that based on my perception of the witness, I believed him or disbelieved him, the workers' comp board would stand back and say, we'll defer to the referee. On the other hand, if I didn't say anything, I just made findings of facts, and I didn't say anything about credibility, the board said, well, we don't know. Now, we'll just review the transcript, we'll review the exhibits, and we'll make a decision. Is what you're telling us that as to the Employment Appeals Board, they don't do it that way, that you have to try to read those findings and read the tea leaves and try to figure out